Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the final Warbirds in Review presentation for 2014. You are on Bolin Warbirds in Review Plaza, dedicated just this week in honor of myself and my husband. We are the founders of Warbirds in Review, so I thank all of you for attending. Thank you. Without all of you to attend, this would not be the popular program that it is without the many, many volunteers that make this happen. And I would like to take a few moments. I don't want to scare all of you off. I'm not going to talk for very long. Without the volunteers, the aircraft owners, the veterans, the sponsors, this program is totally funded from contributions from some donors and our bomb over here. At the end of the week, I go, okay, great. People loved it. They gave me a dollar. It is totally an EA, Warbirds of America. The improvements you see this year were approved by your EAA Warbirds of America board. And we, through the generosity of several donors, I would like to name the three specific. John O'Connor made a significant contribution. Jim Hagedorn, Scott's Miracle-Gro Company, and Jack Roush, Roush Aviation, are to thank for this. So, yes, they deserve a hand. And with their donations, we were able to employ the Sleeping Dog Productions Company. Scott Guyatt, I know they're hiding in the wings. There's no way they'd be out here. Scott Guyatt, his wife Kyle, John Tennyson, and their tremendous crew. They have done a phenomenal job this week. We've done air-to-air. We have the Jumbotron. So we are going to continue to make this bigger and better. Hope you'll come back to see us next year. All the museums that that have supported our efforts with the bringing of their aircraft, they're listed on this banner, but you can rarely see it, but I'm not going to try to name all of them. So follow all of them. Their websites are up there if you want to take a look at the banner. And again, the volunteers who really need to be recognized, our line crew here does a just outstanding job of moving these airplanes in and out. You know, it's Connie, where do you want this one? Where do you want that? Well, I don't know. Let's stand by. You know, we'll change that. So to my line crew guys, Mike Wagnon is lead on that. Mike's probably hiding around here. They're all camera shy, and so am I. But to my moderators, Sam Bass, David Hartman, Danny Bolin, my brother-in-law. Danny was supposed to do this one, so it's okay, Connie. I have to go somewhere. Can you fill in? So here I am. So you get, but it gives me a chance to say thank you to all of these people. And now I would like to introduce Bob Carden with the Lewis Flying Legends. Did I get that right, Lewis? all the museums, the Lewis Air Legends. I knew it didn't have flying in it. Bob Carden is the person who found Glacier Girl or dug it out of the
ice. Yeah, I was the project manager for the recovery.
He was the project manager for the recovery and then in charge of the restoration. So I think I will turn it over to Bob, who has made this presentation just a few times, and then I will be back a little later to introduce a special guest who has some firsthand or almost firsthand knowledge about the P-38. So, Bob, it's all yours, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Connie. And thank you, folks. Today's a pretty special day for me because 22 years ago yesterday, we got that airplane up out of the glacier. Hard to believe it's been 22 years already. And if I do mess up the story, I've only been doing this presentation for 22 years. So I'll do my best to keep all the facts straight. Are there any P-38 pilots in the audience here? Not a one. How about World War II veterans? I know there's plenty of veterans here, so just raise your hands. Let's recognize all of the folks that have, you know, risked their lives to guarantee the freedoms that we have today. And thank you for your service. Now, what I'd like to do today is tell you a little bit about P-38 Glacier Girl. I was the project manager for the recovery in 1992, and then I was the man responsible to restore the airplane back to flyable condition. We first flew, believe it or not, 12 years ago. It's hard to believe. Time really marches on. Well, anyway, this airplane was with a group of airplanes that were being flown from England, correction, from the United States to England to fight in World War II. They were part of this Operation Bolero. Now, the Bolero missions were set up by General Hap Arnold because as we were entering the war in Europe, the main way to get munitions to the war zone was to put them on ships. And the Germans would send out their U-boats, and they were sinking the ships, and we were losing about 38% of our war stockage. And that was not an acceptable loss rate to General Hap Arnold. So he told his staff, come up with a plan, all right, to reduce my losses. Well, they come up with a plan. It was called Operation Bolero. Simply speaking, they were going to fly the airplanes to England. This airplane was part of the second and third combined flights of Operation Bolero. The flight path was generally from Presque Isle, Maine, Goose Bay, Labrador, into Greenland at place we call it Kulusuk now, but it's BW-8 back then. Fly across Greenland into Iceland, get gas, and then continue on into England. Well, initially there was 8 P-38s and 2 B-17s, and on departure from BW-8, two of the P-38s broke, so they had to stay on the ground. So now we have 6 P-38s and 2 B-17s flying across Greenland to get to Iceland. They got about halfway across Greenland. They ran into bad weather, and they were forced to fly into the clouds. And at that point there, that started their trouble. Because back in those days, there was no GPS, there was no VOR, there was no NDB. There was absolutely no navigation aids in Greenland. So they were flying what we all know as pilot's dead reckoning, time, distance, and heading. Well, they lost visual reference to the ground, so they had no idea what their ground track was. So they were just flying off their compass and their clocks. When they thought they were close to Iceland, they called for landing instructions, and they received back a coded message that the airport was closed because of ice fog. Believing that, they decided that they would, after some discussion brief, they decided that they would go to their alternate airport in BW-1, which today we call that Narsarsuaq. They turned to the south and west and flew for a couple of hours, called for landing instructions. They received back the same coded message that the airport was closed. Holy mackerel, what are you going to do now? All right, let's go back to where we started from. So they decided they would go back to Kulusuk or BW-8. Turned to the north and west and flew for a couple more hours. The clouds started to break up. They dove underneath the clouds. And then at that point there, they realized that there was something really wrong because the ocean was on the wrong side of Greenland. They were anticipating being on the west coast, but they were on the east coast. What happened was, as they were flying in the clouds, their compasses were off because of their closeness to the North Pole. So there was a great variation in the compass. And then the winds are a lot stronger than what they thought they were, and they were being blown off course. So instead of going on the track they thought they were on, they were actually just flying like in a big giant circle over the North Sea. They had been airborne for almost 8 hours, and they had to make a decision on what they were going to do. They knew they weren't going to be able to land at an airport to get fuel because there's no airports out there. So they decided that they would stay together as a group and land on a glacier and hope for the best. The first man to land, his name was Brad McManus, and he put his wheels down in an attempt to land on a glacier. When these pilots received their pre-mission briefing prior to departure from BW-8, they were told that it may be possible to land on the glacier if the conditions are right. Now, from altitude, because I've seen it, the glacier looks hard, just like a frozen pond, and these pilots had no experience in the glacier whatsoever, so it really looked promising. So Brad said he dropped his landing gear, and he did like a touch and go. He bounced on it. It felt hard. He came around and landed. As he lost lift, his nose wheel dug into the snow because the surface of the glacier is snow and not ice, and he flipped over on his back. After several minutes, he was able to get out of the cockpit and get on the surface, and he was okay. And the other pilots, and seeing that, and pilots are pretty smart guys, they realized that the right thing to do here is to leave your wheels up and not put them down. So the rest of the P-38s landed without incident. The B-17s, they flew around radioing their position for a couple more hours, and then they came in and land. This all took place on July 15th of 1942. This is the largest forced landing in Air Force history, even to today. There was 25 men, 6 P-38s, and 2 B-17 bombers, all marooned on the glacier. They were about 14 miles in from the ocean, and they were about 14 miles south of the Arctic Circle on the east coast of Greenland. They were on the ice cap for 3 days before they were located by a Navy PBY, and it was on the 11th day that a team from the small fishing village of Amasalik, who proceeded from Amasalik 100 miles to the Don Flyers location, where they had a dog team, and they came up onto the glacier, got the men together, and they walked to the ocean, where the Coast Guard ship, the Northland, came in, picked them up, and they were brought back to safety. The airplanes were abandoned there on the ice, and after the first winter time, they were covered with snow, and the snow would build up and build up and build up on top of these airplanes, never to be seen again.